Krishnamurti, in dialogue with Dr. Alan W. Anderson. J. Krishnamurti was born in South India and educated in England. For the past 40 years, he has been speaking in the United States, Europe, India, Australia, and other parts of the world. From the outset of his life's work, he repudiated all connections with organized religions and ideologies and said that his only concern was to set men absolutely, unconditionally free. He is the author of many books, among them The Awakening of Intelligence, The Urgency of Change, Freedom from the Known, and The Flight of the Eagle. This is one of a series of dialogues between Krishnamurti and Dr. Alan W. Anderson, who is professor of religious studies at San Diego State University, where he teaches Indian and Chinese scriptures and the oracular tradition. Dr. Anderson, a published poet, received his degree from Columbia University and the Union Theological Seminary. He has been honored with a Distinguished Teaching Award from the California State Universities.
Mr. Krishnamurti, in our last conversation together, we had moved from speaking together concerning fear and the relation between that and transformation of the individual person, which is not dependent on knowledge or time. And then from that, we went to pleasure. And just as we reached the end of the conversation, the question of beauty arose. And if it's agreeable with you,
yes,
I should like very much for us to explore that together.
One often wonders why museums are so filled with pictures and statues. Is it because man has lost touch with nature and therefore has to go to these museums to look at the other people's paintings, famous paintings, and some of them are really marvelously beautiful? Why do the museums exist at all? I'm just asking. I'm not saying they should or should not. And I've been to many museums all over the world, taken around by experts. And I've always felt I was as though I was being shown around and looking at things that were so, for me, artificial, so other people's expression, what they considered beauty. And I wondered, what is beauty? Because when you read a poem of Keats or some really a poem that a man writes with his heart and with very deep feeling, he wants to convey something to you of what he feels, what he considers to be the most exquisite essence of beauty. And I've looked at great many cathedrals, as you must have, over Europe. And again, this expression of their feelings, their devotion, their reverence to in mason, in rock, in buildings, in marvelous cathedrals. And looking at all this, I'm always surprised when people talk about beauty or write about beauty, whether it is something created by man or something that you see in nature, or it has nothing to do with the with the stone or with the paint or with the world, but something deeply inward.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've often, in discussing with so-called professionals, having a dialogue with them, it appears to me that it's always somewhere out there. The modern painting, modern music, the pop, and so on, so on. It's always somehow so dreadfully artificial. I may be wrong, but so what is beauty? Must it be expressed? That's one question.
Mm-hmm.
Does it need the word, the stone, the color, the paint, or it is something that is cannot possibly be expressed in word, in a building, in a statue? So if we could go into this question of what is beauty, I feel to really go into it very deeply, one must know what is suffering, or understand what is suffering. Because without passion, you can't have beauty. Passion in the sense, not lust, not the passion that comes when there is immense suffering, and the remaining with that suffering, not escaping from it, brings this passion. Perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
passion means the abandonment, the complete abandonment of the me, of the self, the ego.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, a great austerity.
Mm-hmm.
Not the austerity of, as the word means, ash, severe, dry, which the religious people have made into, but rather the austerity of great beauty.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm following you. I really am.
The great sense of dignity, beauty, that is essentially austere.
Mm-hmm.
And to be austere, not verbally or ideologically, but being austere, means total abandonment, letting go of the me. And one cannot let that thing take place if one hasn't deeply understood what suffering is. Because passion comes from the word sorrow. I don't know if you've gone and looked into that word. The root meaning of the word passion is sorrow, from suffering.
To feel.
To feel.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You see, sir, people have escaped from suffering. I think it is very deeply related to beauty. Not that you must suffer. I don't know if I'm...
Not that you must suffer, but...
Oh, that is... That
yes.
We must go a little more slowly. I'm jumping too quickly. First of all, we assume we know what beauty is.
Yes.
we see Picasso or Rembrandt or Michelangelo, and we think, ah, how marvelous that is. We think we know. We've read it in books, and the experts have written about it, and so on. One reads and says, yes, we absorb it through others. But if one was really inquiring into what is beauty, there must be great sense of humility. Wasn't there? I mean, no, I don't know what beauty is. Actually, I can imagine what beauty is. I have learned what beauty is. I have been taught from in schools and colleges, in reading books and going on tours, guided tours and all the rest, visiting 1,000 museums. But actually, to find out the depth of beauty, the depth of color, the depth of feeling, the mind must start with great sense of humility. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
This as I one really one doesn't know what meditation is. One thinks one knows. When we discuss meditation, will come. So one must start, I feel, if one is inquiring into beauty, with great sense of humility, not knowing. That very not knowing is good.
Yes. I've been listening, and I've been trying to open myself to this relation that you're making between beauty and passion.
Mm.
And
you see, sir. Let's start. Man suffers. Not only personally, but there is immense suffering of man. It is a thing that is pervading the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Man has suffered physically, psychologically, spiritually, in every way for centuries upon centuries. The mother cries because her son is killed. The mother cries, or the wife cries because her husband is being mutilated in a war. Or there's tremendous suffering in the world. I don't think people are aware or even feel this immense sorrow that is in the world. They are so concerned with their own personal sorrow, they overlook the sorrow that a poor man in a little village in India or in China or in the Eastern world can never possibly have a full meal, clean clothes, comfortable bed. And there is the sorrow of thousands of people being killed in war or in the totalitarian world, millions being executed for ideologies, tyranny, the terror of all that. So there is all this sorrow in the world. And there is also the personal sorrow. And without really understanding it very, very, very deeply and resolving it, passion won't come out of sorrow. And without passion, how can you see beauty? you can intellectually appreciate a painting or a poem or a statue, but you need this great sense of inward bursting of passion. Exploding of passion. And in that creates in itself the sensitivity that can see beauty. So it is, I think, rather important to understand sorrow. I think it is related beauty, passion, sorrow.
I'm interested in the order of those words. Beauty, passion, sorrow. If one is, in relation to the transformation we've been speaking about, to come to beauty, I take it it's a passage from sorrow to passion to beauty.
That's right, sir.
Yes, yes. Please do go on. I understand.
You see, in the Christian world, if I'm not mistaken, sorrow is delegated to a person.
Yes.
And through that person, or we somehow escape from sorrow. Or at least we hope to escape from sorrow. Mm-hmm. And in the Eastern world, sorrow is rationalized through the statement that of karma. You know, the word karma means to do. And they believe in karma. That's what you have done in the past life. You pay for it in the present or reward it in the present. And so on and so on. So there are these two categories of escapes. And there are 1,000 escapes. Whiskey, drug, sex, going off to attend the mass and so on and so on. Man has never stayed with a thing. He's always either sought comfort in a belief, in an action, in identification with something greater than himself and so on and so on. But he has never said, look, I must see what this is. I must penetrate it and not delegate it to somebody else. I must go into it. I must face it. I must look at it. I must know what it is. So, when the mind doesn't escape from this sorrow, either personal or the sorrow of man, if you don't escape, if you don't rationalize, if you don't try to go beyond it, if you are not frightened of it, then you remain with it. Because any movement from what is, or any movement away from what is a dissipation of energy. Prevents you actually understanding what is. The what is sorrow. And we have means and ways and cunning development of escapes. Now, if there is no escape whatsoever, then you remain with it. I don't know if you have ever done it. Because in everyone's life, there is an incident that brings you tremendous sorrow, a happening. It might be an incident, a word, an accident, a shattering sense of absolute loneliness, and so on. These things happen. And with that comes this sense of utter sorrow. Now, if you when the mind can remain with that, not move away from it, out of that comes passion. Mm-hmm. Not the cultivated passion, not the artificial trying to be passionate, but the movement of passion is born out of this non-withdrawal from sorrow. It is the total, completely remaining with that.
I'm thinking that we also say, when we speak of someone in sorrow, that they are disconsolate.
Yes, disconsolate.
Disconsolate. And immediately we think that the antidote to that is to get rid of the dis. Not to stay with the dis. And in an earlier conversation, we spoke about two things related to each other in terms of opposite sides of the same coin. And while you've been speaking, I've been seeing the interrelation in a polar sense between action and passion. Passion being able to undergo, able to be changed, whereas action is doing to effect change. And this would be the movement from sorrow to passion at the precise point, if I've understood you correctly, where I become able to undergo what is there.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, when there is no escape, when there is no desire to seek comfort away from what is, then out of that absolute, inescapable reality comes this claim of passion. And without that, there is no beauty. You may write endless volumes about beauty, or be a marvelous painter. But without that inward quality of passion, which is the outcome of great understanding of sorrow, I don't see how beauty can exist. Also, one observes, man has lost touch with nature.
Oh, yes.
Completely. Especially in big towns. Mm-hmm. And even in small towns or hamlets, man is always outwardly going, outward. Mm-hmm. Pursued by his own thoughts. And so he's more or less lost touch with nature. Nature means nothing to him. Yes, it's very nice, very beautiful. Once I was standing with two friends and my brother many years ago, our Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. Look at the marvelous thing.
Yes.
Incredible. The colors, the depth and the shadows. And a group of people came, and one lady says, "Yes, isn't it marvelous?" And the next day, "Let's go and have tea." And off they trotted. That too. you follow? That is what is happening in the world. We have lost completely touch with nature. We don't know what it means. And also we kill. You follow? We kill for food. We kill for amusement. We kill what's called for sport. I won't go into all that. So there is this lack of intimate relationship with nature.
I remember a shock, a profound shock that I had in my college days. I was standing on the steps of the administration building and watching a very, very beautiful sunset. And one of my college acquaintances asked me what I was doing. And I said, well, I'm not doing anything. I'm looking at the sunset. And you know what he said to me? This so shocked me that it's one of those things that you never forget. He just said, well, there's nothing to prevent it, is there?
Nothing?
Nothing to prevent it, is there?
Right.
Yes, I know. I follow you.
So, you see, we are becoming more and more artificial, more and more superficial, more and more verbal, a linear direction, neither vertical, not vertical at all, but linear. And so, naturally, artificial things become more important. Theaters, cinemas, you know, the whole business of modern world. And very few have this sense of beauty in themselves, beauty in conduct. Beauty in behavior, beauty in the usage of their language, the voice, the manner of walking, the sense of humility. With that humility, everything becomes so gentle, quiet, full of beauty. We have none of that. And yet we go to museums, you know, we are educated in with museums, with pictures, and we have lost the delicacy, the sensitivity of the mind, the heart, the body. And so when we have lost the sensitivity, how can we know what beauty is? And when we haven't got sensitivity, we go off to some place to learn to be sensitive. you know that.
Oh, I do.
Go to a college or some ashrama or some rotten hole, and there I'm going to learn to be sensitive. Sensitive through touch, through, you know.
Yes.
That becomes disgusting. So, now how can we, as you are a professor and teacher, how can you, sir, educate, becomes really very important, as the students to have this quality. Therefore, I ask, what is it we are educated for? What are we being educated for? Everybody is being educated.
Yes.
90% of the people probably in America are being educated. Know what to read and write and all the rest of it. What for?
And yet it's a fact, at least in my experience of teaching class after class, year after year, that with all this proliferation of publishing and so-called educational techniques, students are without as much care to the written word and the spoken word as was the case that I can distinctly remember years ago. Now perhaps other teachers have had a different experience, but I've watched this in my classes. And the usual answer that I get when I speak to my colleagues about this is, well, the problem's in the high schools. And then you talk to a poor high school,
and
then he puts it on the poor grade school. So we have poor grade school, poor high school, poor college, poor university, because we're always picking up where we left off, which is a little lower next year from where it was before.
So I'm sorry. That's why I've talked in various universities and so on and so on. I've always felt, what are we being educated for? To just become glorified clerks?
Well, that's what it turns out to be.
Of course it is. Glorified businessmen and all, God knows what else. What for? I mean, if I have a son, that would be a tremendous problem for me. Fortunately, I haven't got a son, but it would be a burning question to me. What am I to do with the children that I have? To send to all these schools where they are taught nothing but just how to read and write a book and how to memorize and forget the whole field of life. They are taught about sex and reproduction, all that kind of stuff, but what? So I feel, sir, I mean, to me this is a tremendously important question because I'm concerned with several schools in India and in England there's one, and we're going to form one here in California. It is a burning question. What is it that we are doing with our children? Making them into another robots or into other clever, cunning clerks? Great scientists who will invent this or that and then be ordinary, cheap little human beings? Shoddy minds? You follow, sir?
I am.
So, when you talk about beauty, can a human being tell another, educate another to grow in beauty, grow in goodness, to flower in great affection, care? Because if we don't do that, we're destroying the earth, as it is happening now, polluting the air. We human beings are destroying everything we touch. So this becomes a very, very serious thing when we talk about beauty, when we talk about pleasure, fear, relationship, order, and so on, all that. None of these things are being taught in any school.
No, I brought that up in my class yesterday. And I asked them directly that very question. And they were very ready to agree that here we are, we're in an upper division course, and we've never heard about this.
And tragic. You follow, sir?
Furthermore, we don't know whether we're really hearing it for what it really is, because we haven't heard about it. We've got to go through that yet to find out whether we're really listening.
And whether the teacher or the man who is professing is honest enough to say, look, I don't know. I'm going to learn about all this. So that's why Western civilization, I'm not condemning it, I'm
observing. No.
Western civilization is mainly concerned with commercialism, consumerism, and a society that is immoral. And when we talk about the transformation of man, not in the field of knowledge or in the field of time, but beyond that, who are interested in this? You follow, sir? Who really cares about it? Because the mother goes off to earn a job, earn a livelihood, the father goes off, and the child is just an incident.
Now, as a matter of fact, I know this will probably appear like an astonishingly extravagant statement for me to make, but I think it's getting to the place now where, if anyone raises this question at the level that you have been raising it, as a young person, say, growing up in his adolescent years, let us say, and he won't let it go. He hangs in there with it, as we say. The question is seriously raised whether he's normal.
Yes, quite.
And it makes one think of Socrates, who was very clear that he knew only one thing that he didn't know. And he didn't have to say that very often, but he said it even the few times enough to get him killed. But at least they took him seriously enough to kill him.
Kill him.
Today, I think he'd be put in some institution for study. It would have to be, the whole thing would have to be checked out.
Well, that's what's happening in Russia. They send him off to an asylum,
yeah, that's right,
mental hospital, and destroy him.
Yeah.
You know, we neglect everything for some superficial gain. Money. Money means power, position, authority, everything. Money.
It goes back to the success thing that you mentioned before. Always later. Always later. On a horizontal axis. Yes. So, but when you, excuse me,
please.
I did want to share with you, as you were speaking about nature, something that has a sort of wry humor about it in terms of the history of scholarship. I thought of those marvelous Vedic hymns to dawn.
Oh, yes.
Which, Dakshina, that the way dawn comes, rosy-fingered. And scholars have expressed surprise that the number of hymns to her are, by comparison, few compared with some other gods. But the attention is drawn in the study not to the quality of the hymn as revealing how it is that there's such consummately beautiful cadences associated with her, for which you'd only need one, wouldn't you? You wouldn't need 25. The important thing is, isn't it remarkable that we have so few hymns, and yet they're so wonderfully beautiful? What has the number to do with it at all?
Is the
thing that I could never get answered for myself in terms of the environment in which I studied Sanskrit and the Veda. The important thing is to find out which god, in this case Indra, is in the Rig Veda mentioned most often. Now, of course, I'm not trying to suggest that quantity should be overlooked, but by no means. But if the question had been approached the way you have been inquiring into it, deeper, then I think scholarship would have had a very, very different career. We should have been taught how to sit and let that hymn disclose itself and stop measuring it.
Yes, sir.
Yes, please. Please do go on.
That's what I was going to say. See, when discussing beauty and passion and sorrow, we ought to go into the question also of what is action.
Yes.
Because it is related to all that.
Yes, of course.
What is action? Because life is action. Living is action. Speaking is action. Everything is action. Sitting here is an action. Talking. A dialogue, discussing, going into things, is a series of actions, a movement in action. So, what is action? Action obviously means acting now. Not having acted or will act. It is the active present of the word act, to act, which is acting all the time. Otherwise, there's no... It is a movement in time and out of time. We'll go into that a little bit later. Now, so what is action that does not bring sorrow? You follow? One has to put that question, because every action, as we do now, is either regret, contradiction, a sense of meaningless movement, a repression, conformity, and so on. So that is action for most people. The routine, the repetition, the remembrance of things past, and act according to that remembrance. So, unless one understands very deeply what is action, one will not be able to understand what is sorrow. So, action, sorrow, passion, and beauty. They're all together, not divorced, not something separate. And beauty is at the end, action is at the beginning. It isn't like that at all. It's all one thing. But to look at it, what is action? As far as one knows now, action is according to a formula, according to a concept, or according to an ideology, the communist ideology, the capitalist ideology, or socialist ideology, or the ideology of a Christian Jesus Christ ideology, or the Hindu with his ideologies. So, action is the approximation to of an idea. I act according to my concept. That concept is traditional, or put together by me, or put together by an expert. Lenin, Marx have formulated, and they conform according to what they think Lenin, Marx. And action is according to a pattern. You follow?
Yes, I do. What's occurring to me is that under the tyranny of that, one is literally driven.
Absolutely. Driven, conditioned, brutalized. You don't care for anything except for ideas and carrying out ideas. See what's happening in China and you follow in Russia.
Yes, I do.
And here too, the same thing in a modified form. So, action as we know it now is conformity to a pattern, either in the future or in the past, an idea which I carry out. A resolution or a decision which I fulfill in acting. The past is acting. So it is not action. I don't know.
Yes. Well, I'm aware of the fact that we suffer a radical conviction that if we don't generate a pattern, there will be no order.
So, you follow what is happening, sir? Order is in terms of a pattern.
Yes. Preconceived. Yes.
Therefore, it is disorder that against which an intelligent mind fights. Fights in the sense, revolves. So that's why it is very important, if we are to understand what beauty is, we must understand what action is. Can there be action without the idea? Idea means, you must know from Greek, means to see. Mm-hmm. See what we have done, sir. The word is to see. That is, seeing and the doing. Not the seeing, draw a conclusion from that, and then act according to that conclusion. You see what?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yes.
See, perceiving, from that perception, draw a belief, an idea, a formula, and act according to that belief, idea, formula. So we are removed from perception. We are acting only according to a formula. Therefore, mechanical.
Just occurred to me.
You see, sir, how our minds have become mechanical.
Necessarily so.
It's obvious.
Yes. I just thought about Greek sculpture and its different character from Roman sculpture.
Okay.
The finest of
the Pericles
ancient
and
Greek
and so on. Yeah.
Sculpture is extremely contemplative. It's sometimes been remarked that the Romans had a genius for portraiture in stone, and of course
law and order and all that.
Yes, and of course one would see their remarkable attention to personality. But what occurred to me while I was listening to this is something that had never occurred to me before. That the Greek statue with which one sometimes asks himself, well, the face doesn't disclose a personality. Perhaps the quiet eye recognized that you don't put onto the stone something that must come out of the act itself.
Quite, quite.
Because you're doing something that you must wait to come to pass. The Greeks were correct. It's an expression of that relation to form, which is an interior form. Marvelous grasp of that. It's a grasp that allows for splendor.
Yes, sir.
To break out, rather than the notion that we must represent it. Yes. I am following you, aren't I?
You see, sir, that's why one must ask this essential question. What is action? Is it a repetition? Is it imitation? Is it an adjustment between what is and what should be or what has been? Or is it a conformity to a pattern, or to a belief, or to a formula? If it is, then inevitably there must be conflict. Because idea, action, there's an interval, a lag of time between the two, and in that interval, great many things happen. A division in which other incidents take place. And therefore there must be inevitably conflict. Therefore action is never complete. Action is never
total. It is never ending. Action means ending. You know, you used the word Vedanta the other day. It means the ending of knowledge, I was told.
Mm-hmm.
Not the continuous of knowledge, but the ending. That is the free, all that. So, now, is there an action which is not tied to the past as time, or to the future, or to a formula, or to a belief, or to an idea, but action? The seeing is the doing.
Yes.
The seeing is the doing becomes an extraordinary a movement in freedom. The other is not freedom. And therefore, sir, the communists said there is no such thing as freedom. That's a bourgeois idea. Of course it is bourgeois idea, because they live in ideas, concepts, not in action. They live according to ideas and carry those ideas out in action, which is not action. They're doing. I don't know.
Oh, yes. I was just thinking.
And this is what we'll do in the Western world, in the Eastern world, and all over the world, is acting according to a formula, idea, belief, a concept, a conclusion, a decision. And never the seeing and the doing.
I was thinking about the cat, the marvelous animal, the cat.
The cat, oh yes.
Its face is almost all eye.
Yes.
I don't mean that by measure with calipers, of course not. And we don't train cats like we try to train dogs. I think we've corrupted dogs. Cats won't be corrupted. They simply won't be corrupted. And it seems to me a great irony that in the Middle Ages we should have burned cats along with witches.
the ancient Egyptians worshipped cats.
Yes. The great eye of the cat, I read some time ago that the cat's skeletal structure is among mammals the most perfectly adapted to its function.
Quite.
And I think one of the most profound occasions for gratitude in my life was the living with a cat, and she taught me how to make an end.
Yeah.
But I went through a lot of interior agony before I came to understand what she was doing. It's as though one would say of her that she was performing a mission, we might say, without, of course, being a missionary in the ordinary sense of the word. Yes.
Yes, you see, one begins to see what freedom is in action.
That's right.
And it is the seeing in the doing is prevented by the observer, who is the past, the formula, the concept, the belief. That observer comes in between perception and the doing.
Mm-hmm.
That observer is the factor of division, the idea and the conclusion in action. So can we act only when there's perception? We do this, sir, when we are at the edge of a precipice. The seeing danger is instant action.
If I remember correctly, the word alert comes from the Italian, which points to standing at the edge of a cliff.
Cliff. That's right.
That's pretty serious.
You see, but it's very interesting. We are conditioned to danger of a cliff, of a snake or a dangerous animal and so on. Mm-hmm. We are conditioned. But we are not conditioned to, and we are conditioned also to this idea, you must act according to an idea, otherwise there is no act.
No, we are conditioned to that.
To that.
Oh yes, terribly so.
Terribly. So we have this condition to danger, and condition to the fact that you cannot act without a formula, without a concept, belief and so on. So these two are the factors of our conditioning. And now someone comes around and says, look, that's not action. That's merely a repetition of what has been. Modified, but it's not action. Action is when you see and do.
And the reaction to that is, oh, I see, he has a new definition of action.
Yes, and I'm not defining.
Yes, of course not.
I mean, I've done this my life, all my life. I see something and I do it.
Yes.
Say, for instance, as you may know, I'm not being personal or anything. A great big organization, spiritual organization with thousands of followers, with great deal of land, 5,000 acres, castles and money and so on, were formed around me as a board. And in 1928, I said, this is all wrong, I dissolved it. Returned the property and so on.
Yes.
This, I saw how wrong it was. The seeing, not the conclusion, say, how comparison, no. Say, how religions have done. I saw and acted.
Exactly.
And therefore, there's never been a regret.
Marvelous.
Never been said, oh, I made a mistake, but, sir, because I shall have nobody to lean on. You follow?
Yes, I do. Could we next time, in our next conversation, relate beauty to seeing?
I was going there.
Oh, splendid. Yes, that's wonderful.